From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, the astonishing cures and enhancements that scientists have in store for the human brain. Also, the search for Cardona on the trail of a 16th century Mexican treasure. It's an academic detective story that took 25 years to unfold. And prolific crime writer Peter May, his new novel is titled Virtually Dead. But first, when the rest of the world thinks of California, technology is probably part of the image. But day-to-day reality in many public school classrooms is at odds with that. California currently ranks among the lowest of the states in education technology use. There's a bill in the state legislature that aims to raise the level of technology used to deliver instruction in California public schools. It's our first topic today on Insight. We'll start with the bill's author, Assemblyman Tom Torlakson. Welcome to Insight.
Good morning.
What does it mean that California ranks low among the states in education technology use?
Well, sadly and ironically, we have fewer computers, less access to the internet, less access to the global network of information than other students in other states. We're ranked about 47th in the nation in the use of technology in instructing, whether it's math or history or science. We're behind, and we need to get going.
And why are we behind?
It's a lack of investment, I think a lack of planning. It's a combination of lack of financial resources and planning. And legislation we're looking at is aimed at getting a planning model together, getting a planning process very definite.
Give us a bit more of an idea of what your bill would do if it were to become law.
It would create a task force of experts, teachers, administrators, technology experts from the industry who would look at, number one, what's the need? Assess the need in California, then look at continued funding. What are the funding sources we can guarantee to flow into the schools? How to close the digital divide? And then finally, to define a common foundation so that 1,000 different school districts aren't purchasing in different frameworks and foundations, that we have a common set of goals, of specifications for how to invest in the technology we need.
Assemblyman Tom Torlakson, he's a Democrat and author of a bill that aims to improve the use of technology in California classrooms. Also with us is Jonathan Raymond, superintendent of Sacramento City Unified School District. Jonathan Raymond, welcome.
Good morning.
How does this bill sound to you? Does it sound like it's fixing a problem that you see in the schools? And do you think it's sufficient to address that problem?
We need a lot of help. So anywhere we can get that help to get more technology in the classroom is going to be important for us. And we need to support every effort. I want to talk about one of our schools today, Earl Warren Elementary School, which is not too far from the studio. And what I want to leave the image of is this is a school where 100% of the children come from families that live in poverty. The school has never been in school improvement. It's never been a program improvement school. And this year, by federal and both state standards, it just made over 800 on its API. In every one of those classrooms, every day, we see technology fully using to engage those students. Smart boards, overhead LCDs, document scanners, and students using clickers to be engaged in instruction. I go in that classroom with the principal, and students don't even bother to look up because they're so engaged. That's the world that our children live in. Whether you're rich or you're poor doesn't mean you can't have or should have or don't know how to use technology, and that's where we need to be in California today.
Well, why don't the other classrooms in your district have those tools?
So when I asked the principal, how did she do it? Well, she said it took her 3 years using various categorical funding. She didn't have the support from the school district at the time. So she had to basically, you know, rob Peter to pay Paul to find different sources over time, you know, buy 3 projectors this year, buy 4 next year. So I think it takes both making these things a priority, and that's certainly something we're going to do here at the school district level, but it also has to be at the state level. It requires leadership at all levels.
You used to be the superintendent in Charlotte, North Carolina. Is it better or worse there when it comes to technology in the classroom?
Well, I was actually the chief accountability officer.
That's right. I beg your pardon.
Yes, there is more of a focus on using technology and more technology support from the state in North Carolina. And I would also say it's important, the private partnerships. Lots of commitments from industry where I was in Charlotte, large banking and private sector support there. But that can exist here in California, too, with our corporations and companies.
Okay. Well, we've established the need for more of this in Sacramento City schools. But back to the bill, how does it sound to you? Does it sound like it's enough? Does it sound like a step in the right direction?
I think it's a start, absolutely. And I commend the assemblyman for pushing it and the legislature. We need this help and support, but it is just a start. And starts aren't a place where we want to finish, but we needed to have it to be a rallying point for the community. We have tremendous support and resources in this state, in many ways, second to none. And I've come from other states. The question is about priorities. Are we going to invest, and are we going to put our resources in our future? Those are the critical questions that all of us in California need to decide.
Jonathan Raymond, superintendent of Sacramento City Unified School District. We're talking about a bill. Its official name is AB 2019, that aims to improve the use of technology in California classrooms. It goes before the Assembly Education Committee this week. The author is Assemblyman Tom Torlakson. Our third guest is Joe Brumfield, who is Regional Vice President of Pearson K-12 Solutions. Joe, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
Well, obviously, you work in the private sector. How does California look to you as someone who works for a company that creates educational materials?
Sure. Well, Pearson has been thought of as a huge publishing house, a textbook publishing house, and we have thousands of textbooks in and around California. I would say most students in California use one of our textbooks. But what I don't think people understand is that for years now, every textbook that we've produced have had a digital path that accompanied it. For years now, every textbook that we produce has had an online companion where students can actually go to their exact same textbook online, read it, do their homework, get interactive examples, even the ability to answer some questions right there online that get fed right back to the teacher. Unfortunately, these types of pieces are underused in California, exactly what the Assemblyman bill talks about, that they have the technology there. We've had it there for years, but the ability for teachers and students to actually access it constantly is what we're hoping to get caught up on.
Why would Pearson like more use in California of the online materials? Is it because of, or partly because, it would save you money?
Sure, it's a money-saving issue, but I don't think that's what leads our calls there. We've been investing in this for quite a while without obviously seeing any return on it. But what it does is it increases what students are able to do, and that's what at the heart of Pearson. I mean, we're an educational company built by a lot of educators. I taught for years. Everyone I've ever worked for in Pearson taught for years. So our goal is to see students in California do better, and we know that the use of technology will do that for them.
In your experience, are there any states that are particularly far ahead of California in making use of online learning materials and related stuff?
You mentioned North Carolina. I know that they do a lot. I know West Virginia, in fact, does a lot of online testing. If you look at Florida, Florida Virtual Schools is a company that's in Florida that Pearson has now partnered with as well. But there are states who have really moved ahead on what they require students and teachers to do with technology.
Assemblyman Tom Torlakson, your bill would create a task force, and governments create task forces all the time and nothing much happens to them. How do you know anything would come out of the task force that your bill would create?
Well, we're creating momentum. It's a rallying point, as the superintendent mentioned, for discussion and debate. And the industry itself and the experts, the teachers, the users, the students, to define what's needed. And so beyond talking about it, it's truly a rallying point to focus as a springboard to get to implementation, to identify funding sources, go after them aggressively, to provide that foundation, which will save school districts money by setting out specific criteria. So there's a commitment we've had from Pearson, Apple, Google, Microsoft, AT&T, Tech America to be involved, and the top teachers in the state who use technology to come out with a work product that the legislature will then pay attention to because it has consensus around it.
If this effort of improving and enhancing and increasing the use of technology in California classrooms is badly needed, why would the task force that your bill would create be funded by private donations? Why isn't this in the public interest to put public money into it?
We should put the public money in. Obviously, we're in a huge budget crisis, and it's been billions of cuts instead of adding the billions we need to enhance our classrooms. So this is one way to get the job done, and I believe it will work. We also have an Ed Expo, a Tech Expo coming, where the students themselves will show legislators here later this week the excitement they have and the great facility they have in using technology to learn.
Last year, you wrote a bill that seemed related. It would require the superintendent of public instruction in California to develop technology literacy standards, but Governor Schwarzenegger vetoed it. Is your current bill based on that? And if not, what did you learn from that bill being vetoed that informs the current one?
Well, that bill was vetoed, but some of the work has been done to develop digital literacy standards. So that's sort of on a parallel track to this needs assessment and funding assessment task force effort. So the focus we gave created some momentum, and the governor and his staff and some of the technology folks in California got together to develop these standards. We need to go farther, but it created momentum. So sometimes a task force and the mere convening around an idea creates momentum towards the change we need.
Jonathan Raymond of Sacramento City Unified School District, where's the federal government in all of this? Is the federal government requiring anything, putting any money into any efforts like this?
Through the various funding streams that are available now through innovation grants, Race to the Top, there were lots of opportunities for school districts to potentially get involved. And I underscore potentially because they're competitions. So at the other end, somebody's judging your submission, which I think is part of the challenge that that we have. You can have the money. Here's the carrot, but there's a stick attached to it. You know, you have to meet our criteria, or you have to do things in a way that spells out you're going to follow our priorities. So I think there's some good with it, but it also makes it difficult to get access to those dollars, and so therefore we're really relegated right now to looking at using categorical dollars, many of which are either restricted or we've had to use those to save jobs over the last 2 years with this economic downturn. So in short, I think a lot needs to be done, and I think they need to provide more flexibility and opportunity for school districts and states, frankly, that haven't been part of. You know, California, our application didn't get accepted for Race to the Top. So what does that leave us out here to do right now? Wait for the next round, or are there going to be other opportunities? And so I think the federal government needs to really step it up and to create more creative channels for funding so that school districts that want to be innovative, that can create some partnerships, can decide maybe we need to go it alone or with some other partners. Don't hold us back.
Joe Brumfield of Pearson, do you see in the foreseeable future classrooms not using printed books anymore?
Oh, absolutely. Not only do I see it, I have seen it. You know, in classroom visitations down in San Diego, for instance, whiteboards, Superintendent Raymond talked about having whiteboards and clickers in his classrooms there.
A whiteboard in the digital sense.
Whiteboard in the digital sense. Thanks for that clarification, because that is actually what a whiteboard actually is used for. You plug it into your computer, and all your lessons can be delivered right over the whiteboard. And in San Diego, they're doing a lot of that. You talk about classroom sizes being increased, and you can look at a situation where a classroom size can be increased from 30 to 45. Well, in San Diego, 15 of those kids can be taking the class virtually, just getting the lesson right off the whiteboard, because all of our lessons are produced right on the whiteboard, and actually not having to physically be in the classroom. I think it's growing in popularity, and I think it's definitely a place that we want to be in the future.
And finally, Assemblyman Tom Torlakson, when lawmakers run for statewide office, it's funny how they often seem to write legislation that relates to the job that they're running for. You are running for superintendent of public instruction along with some other candidates. Does that inform the fact that you wrote this bill that would give you, if you are to be elected superintendent, more tools?
Well, I'm a teacher, and you know, I've visited classrooms around the state, and I see the excitement of students. So that's really what's driving me to follow this area. And absolutely, it is such a tool to enhance learning, to have these various forms of technology, to the teacher with such diversity in a classroom, now more crowded, overcrowded. This is an ability to reach students and have them engage. When you have the clicker system, instead of one student raising their hand and answering, everybody else sitting back and letting that student go, everybody answers, everybody's engaged. And that's just one example of how the technology will work. And obviously, a superintendent of public instruction should be a leader in making sure California is at the forefront, as we should from our invention of the technology. We should be at the forefront in using it with our kids.
Assemblyman Tom Torlakson, he's author of the bill AB 2019 that aims to improve the use of technology in California classrooms. It goes before the Assembly Education Committee this week. Joe Brumfield is Regional Vice President of Pearson K-12 Solutions, and Jonathan Raymond is Superintendent of Sacramento City Unified School District. Thank you all so much for joining us.
pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jeffrey.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, what technology has in store for the brain. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Tell us what you think about Insight. Send it to insight@capradio.org. Coming up on Talk of the Nation, reporter Anne Garrels has covered wars and the like for NPR for 23 years. Now she's decided it's time to leave the battlefield. That's Talk of the Nation after Insight at 11 on Capital Public Radio. Scientists have plenty in store for the human brain, treatments, cures, and enhancements. And this is the subject of a new book by Sacramento science journalist and author Judith Horstman. The book is called The Scientific American Brave New Brain. As you can tell from the title, it's co-published with the popular Science magazine. Judith Horstman also worked with Scientific American on her previous book, Day in the Life of Your Brain. She's in our studio. Judith Horstman, welcome back to Insight.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Welcome.
Give us an example of what scientists are working on that could heal or enhance the human brain.
Well, among other things, they're working on microchips that would be in or on your brain that could be used for a number of things. One would be an artificial memory for people who suffer from Alzheimer's and other problems. They're actually working on some of this in rodents. They're also working on molecules, neurotransmitters, other things to help enhance memory specifically. That's one of the big things, as you know, with the growing Alzheimer's epidemic. And of course, it's driven by the baby boomers. Those of us who are getting older have never settled for less than what we absolutely want. And so we're fighting and screaming to get the technology and the science to help us go into a good old age.
What do you mean by microchips that would function as an artificial memory? Could a microchip actually replace part or all of a human memory?
I think it would more enhance it, and this is all still in the planning stage. And I have to remind everyone that I'm not really a scientist. I'm a journalist. But what they're working on specifically, as I understand it, are some materials that would blend in with your brain, that would actually have your brain grow in and around it, that your nerves, which are the neurons in your brain, would become part of that.
It sounds very science fiction-y. How close is it to being science fact?
Well, let me give you an example. What I say about this book is that it's science fiction becoming science fact. And I do want to say that these are things we're talking about in the future, but not that far in the future. For example, when I was writing this book, I had a section that I wrote about artificial retinas. There already are artificial cochleas that enable deaf people to hear that are implanted in the ear. And they've been working for about 30 years on an artificial retina that would allow some blind people to see. I turned this book into the publisher, and lo and behold, the announcement was made that worldwide, 37 people were now seeing with artificial retinas. Now, these are people whose optical nerves are still functioning, and they're just replacing the retina. The other thing that's amazing, by the way, is thought-driven prostheses. People missing an arm, they have an incredible replacement arm that is driven by the nerves that are left in the shoulder by impulses from your brain. You think about moving the arm, it moves like a real arm. All experimental, but really, it's still being done in people, in humans.
My guest is Judith Horstman, science journalist and author. Her latest book is The Scientific American Brave New Brain. It's about what medicine and technology have in store for the human brain. You also mentioned the use of, or the future use, perhaps, of molecules and other neurotransmitters to enhance memory. How does that work? How can molecules enhance the memory?
We are molecules.
Well, that's true. Just lots of them.
And lots of them. And, well, that, for example, one of the things they've discovered just recently, or that they're talking about with Alzheimer's, the beta amyloid plaque that forms in the brain, they thought was the cause of Alzheimer's. Now they think it may be the result of something else that's happening and not in itself the cause. So they're going deeper and deeper and smaller in finding the causes of these things. And nanomedicine is one of the things I mentioned in a chapter two, which is the science of the unimaginably small. A nano is a billionth of a meter. And anyone might recall that the science fiction movie, The Incredible Voyage, The Fantastic Journey.
Yes, I forget what the exact title was.
We can look it up. But yes. At any rate, in this one, some scientists need to clear a clot in the brain of a very, very famous person. And so they are shrunk in a miniature submarine to molecule size, I think, and they go through the bloodstream, repair the clot, and come out. And Raquel Welch is one of the scientists. Which
yes,
makes
I do recall it now.
Yes, you would remember that. Well, much sexier than Raquel for scientists and those of us today is the idea that this actually could be happening within the next couple of decades. They are now working on these tiny nanorobots. I don't ask me how that works, nanobots, or tiny nanoparticles that have perhaps a lipid system to go in and deliver medicine to specific parts of the body or brain. They have used these to deliver tiny bits of gold to cancer tumors, then heated the outside of the skin and had the tumor damaged or destroyed by the gold. They're now working on ways to take these specifically into parts of your brain so that many things that were treatable only by surgery, by cutting open your head, could possibly be dealt with non-invasively.
My goodness, that would be an enormous development.
It would. Actually, I have a friend who has a benign brain tumor now, and it's her second one. And surgery is a very, very brutal way to treat something benign. In the future, unfortunately, long beyond our time, I think, that may be able to be treated non-invasively.
Judith Horstman, author of the Scientific American Brave New Brain. You also in your book write about how these microchips that we've talked about could control our cell phones, meaning what?
Well, that's what Philip Kennedy told me, and he's doing fascinating research. He's been working with people with locked-in syndrome, those who are still mentally alert but totally unable to move any part of their body, any at all. And he's planted electrodes in their brains that are picking up signals from when they think about speaking. When they think about speaking and thinking about moving muscles that can no longer move, that impulse goes through the electrode, sometimes wirelessly, to a computer that will be able to speak for them. This is astounding. He's still working on it. And in the course of talking to him about this technology, he's the one who said within 2 decades, we're going to have microchips, possibly on the outside of our brain, that will control our cell phones. I know, it's astounding.
It is. And by the way, I've been told the film we were talking about was Fantastic Voyage.
Oh, thank goodness.
What about drugs? What kind of drugs are being worked on that in the future could treat, cure, or enhance the brain?
I don't know what specific drugs are being worked on, but I know what areas they're working in. They're working in ways to increase focus, the way the ADHD brains, ADHD drugs are being used off-label by people today. They're being used by possibly 20% of college students who don't have ADHD to improve their focus. So drugs similar to that are being worked on. They're also working on drugs that would not just improve your focus, but actually improve your cognitive ability. And they've done some experiments with rodents that have a condition similar to mental retardation and have been able to reverse some of those effects. So the possibility exists in the future that we could perhaps not just avoid situations of mental retardation, but reverse some of the effects.
When you were working on the book, did you come across any research that is purely for lifestyle purposes? In other words, not for treating diseases, illnesses, injuries, whatever, but just stuff that people think would be fun to have their brain do.
Oh, goodness. I was thinking so practically and scientifically. Yes. I didn't think of that. I'll think about that while we
okay.
go on.
What about things going beyond what we can currently do with our brain? For example, you said the microchip could enhance our memory, but are there devices, drugs, and so on that can enhance our brain to the extent that it can do things that brains can't currently do, like reading minds and so on?
Wow, that's a good question. The mind reading issue comes up a lot related to the new brain scan technology, in which the functional MRI, has only been around for maybe 20 years at the tops, allows us for the first time to look at a living brain in real time while it's functioning. And by looking at the parts of the brain that are activated or that have increased blood flow when someone thinks about something or performs a certain action, they've been able to better correlate your activity and your thoughts with your brain. And there's been a lot of controversy about the use of this as, say, a lie detector or as, say, a predictor of behavior, because it shows, for example, that the brains of pedophiles are different from the brains of us who are not. And the subject of neuroethics, which is the last chapter in my book, looks into the potential legal, ethical, and even moral use of these technologies. And the neuroimaging is a big, big hot deal, because a lot of people are saying, well, we should be imaging people's brains so that we can tell those people have a criminal propensity. And since the MRIs are becoming smaller and smaller, there are now handheld ones that can be used to examine a limb, for example, there is the potential that such things would be used, that your brain would be scanned when you go to the airport to see if you have a criminal tendency when you get on there. But this is an invasion of privacy, yes?
Sounds like it.
Yeah.
Although
yeah.
I guess if someone who was going to blow the plane up that I was about to get onto was caught that way, I guess I might feel a little differently. But
that's the trade-off, always the trade-off. Yeah.
What about electrical treatments? It's been very controversial over decades now, the use of electricity to treat the brain. Are scientists still looking at that for the future?
They are. In fact, they're looking at it in a new way. Yes, you're right. It's been very controversial. Some years ago, people discovered, well, they've known for 1,000 years that our brains have electrical current. But they discovered within the last century that we could actually affect the brain with it. Electroshock therapy is still used, by the way. It's sometimes the treatment of last resort for people who are very seriously depressed or suffer from terrible bipolar disease. But it fell into ill repute when it was discovered that you could actually make animals or people do certain things by planting electrodes in their brains and pushing buttons. However, when the great promise of drugs, which followed on that, ran into some problems recently, the neuropsychopharmacology is a huge deal and will continue to be one, as you were asking about treatments to enhance the brain. But it also has a lot of side effects and pitfalls. So some people have turned back to looking at the effect of electricity on the brain. Now, Philip Kennedy, who's doing the deep brain implants for people who have locked-in syndrome, is one person. A scientist named Helen Mayberg absolutely stunned the scientific community less than 10 years ago when she discovered that by using a deep brain implant, you could reverse or stop the effects of depression. People have been chronically depressed all of their lives with a little zap in the right spot are now able to function. The potential is amazing.
No question. Judith Horstmann, science journalist and author. Her latest book is The Scientific American Brave New Brain, about what medicine and technology have in store for your brain and other people's brains. She has a book launch party this Thursday evening at 6 at Revolution Wines in Midtown Sacramento. Judith, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, an academic mystery story. A Davis professor who spent 25 years trying to solve the origins of a 16th century Mexican manuscript. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. For more about the people and topics on our show, go to capradio.org/insight. Tomorrow, NPR's Scott Simon joins us, plus a Holocaust survivor who was a cast member of an opera first performed in a Nazi concentration camp. She's in town for a performance of the same opera. Also, the Sacramento woman who's behind the hundreds of community meltdowns in the nation over the last 10 years. The first was in Nevada County. They're intended to help people lose weight. The search for the Codex Cardona is a real-life academic detective story that unfolds over 25 years. The book's author is Arnold Bauer, a retired UC Davis history professor. The Codex Cardona that he studies is a mid-1500s Mexican manuscript. It was brought to his attention in 1985. After years of work around the world, Arnold Bauer has answered many, but not all, questions about the mysterious Codex Cardona. He joins us. Arnold Bauer, welcome to Insight.
Nice to be here.
What did you think the first time you saw the Codex Cardona? What was your impression of it?
Well, it was a magnificent surprise document. It was brought to the Crocker Lab at the University of California at Davis, and I was able to turn a couple of pages and saw immediately that it was an unusual Mexican painted book, some 400 pages on a native Mexican paper.
What was unusual about it?
The fact that enormous detail, the fact that it was an ancient document, the fact that it would enormously enhance, if not revolutionize, the history of early 16th century Mexico. And one saw the work of artists 500 years old.
When you saw it, did you realize at that point that there were a lot of unanswered questions about it, or was your initial interest simply because it was so unusual and interesting looking?
Well, I knew there were unanswered questions because it was brought to the university, to the Crocker Lab, because for tests on paper and ink, because there was always a suggestion of falsification or fraudulence, and that's the reason it was brought there.
Where had it come from before it was at the Crocker Lab at UC Davis?
No one knew, because that was one of the interesting things. An implausible book dealer sort of came out of the fog and presented it for, well, to Stanford University at this point in order to get tests on the validity of the ink and paper.
And why did they send it to the Crocker Lab at UC Davis? Is it well known for that work?
It had a certain amount of fame for working on the composition of ink in documents. They had the Vinland map, for example, which turned out to be a fraud, and they had certain fame in that material.
My guest is Arnold Bauer. He's a retired professor of history at UC Davis and author of The Search for the Codex Cardona on the Trail of a 16th Century Mexican Treasure. The Codex Cardona was a mysterious document from mid-1500s Mexico. How did you set about answering the questions about the Codex Cardona, starting with where it came from and who made it?
I didn't do this immediately because I was engaged in my own career at the University of California. But after I returned from several years in Chile, I took up the search for it, tracked it back to Stanford, which led to Sotheby's in London and then to the Getty Museum in Los Angeles. So I began to fill in some of, the missing data. And then the trail then of my search led from those places to Seville, to the Princeton, Firestone Library in Princeton University, ultimately to Christie's Auction House in New York City.
My goodness. So,
actually to Mexico City, where I discovered a man who had at one time been the owner of the Codex Cardona.
That's quite a trail of experts and places around the world that you went to. Did you ever think to yourself, is this worth it?
No, I became more and more intrigued. The further I went, the more hooked I became. And the trail is also populated by unusual cast of characters, because there is the implausible book dealer, fraudulent book dealers along the way, a number of interesting characters.
What do you mean by fraudulent book dealers?
Well, people who are presenting this as a falsely representing it, because no one knew, in fact, where it came from, and they were inventing the origin of it. It had three problems. One was the ownership itself, because the owner refused, whoever that was, refused to reveal himself. The other thing was the provenance. Was it a 20th century fraud? Did it come out of Spain or Mexico? Wasn't clear. And then, of course, it was complicated by the fact that it is in the category of cultural patrimony, that it was illegal to sell this across international frontiers. And that led to misrepresentations and secrecy.
Are you satisfied that the Codex Cardona is not a fraud?
Yes,
that it wasn't made this in the 20th century?
No, I'm sure it's the 16th. I'm not totally sure, but I think it's a 16th century, legitimate 16th century codex.
And how do you know that? Is that because of the material that it's written on, the materials that were used to write it?
Well, first of all, Sotheby's, Getty, and Christie's all had it vetted by specialists in the material. And all of those people had certain doubts, but in the end came down on the side of on authenticity.
Do you know why the owner did not want to identify him or herself?
Oh, because of the illegality of its trafficking. Because it was illegal for anyone to sell it outside of Mexico to a Mexican, and yet it was offered for sale at Sotheby's in London, Christie's in New York, Getty, and so on. So he didn't want to do that, didn't want to reveal his own name because of that problem.
What do we know today about the Codex Cardona's origin, and what do we not know?
Well, we know, I think, that it is a legitimate mid-16th century painted book with spectacular information. We don't know where it is because its last station, the last place it was offered, was Christie's in New York. And then we don't know exactly. I have many suggestions. I don't know exactly who took it to Christie's. I'm fairly sure. But I don't know who took it away from Christie's because then it disappeared. And when the owner remonstrated to the person who took it to Christie's, that person said, "I can't give it to you." And what do you mean? It's, "I can't give it to you. It's lost." And it's been lost ever since.
Do we know who made the Codex Cardona and why?
Yeah, it was made by order of the Viceroy of Mexico in the mid-16th century, the highest official in the Spanish colonial regime. He commissioned it to a captain called Cardona, that's the name, and it was made to gather information to send presumably to Spain to the Catholic, to the Spanish monarch as an example of to provide information about the world they were conquering, that is America, that is more specifically colonial Mexico.
So it was a report back to the people who had sent them over to the New World, basically.
Yes, it was an elaborate informe, as they say, an account of life, politics, religion, you name it, in colonial Mexico.
Nowadays, someone like that would send a memo back to Home Office. Why did they take such time and expense, I guess, to make this beautifully illustrated book?
Because that was in the tradition of Mexican painted books. The people who actually drew it up and painted it were native Mexicans, probably mestizos, probably bilingual. It's the first generation after the conquest, so they would have had some knowledge of the European tradition as well, of course, as being steeped in a native tradition. And over their shoulders stood Catholic clergy, Dominicans and Franciscans mainly, who annotated the book. The painters painted the images, and then the Catholic clergy would say, "Well, what does this mean, and what's going on here, what's behind this?" And then when they were told, they would, in the 16th century hand, annotate the document.
Where is the Codex Cardona now?
That's what I don't know.
You don't know.
Now, I follow several tracks, possible hypothetical tracks in the book. One to a hotel owner in Ibiza, in Catalonia, and another a book dealer in Madrid. But I don't know. I'm sorry to tell you, I don't know. I wish I did. I think it will appear again, and then my book sales will boom.
Do you know what the Codex Cardona would be worth if it could be legally sold?
Well, it was offered to Sotheby's for $7 million and to Christie's for about the same thing.
That's an extraordinary amount of money.
Well, that's in 1985 dollars, so it'd presumably be worth more now. Well, these documents sell for a lot. They're priceless. There are two contemporary codexes that are held in Paris, one in Paris and one in Oxford at the library there.
And if the Codex Cardona were to be found again, where do you think it would belong?
It belongs in the National Museum of Anthropology and History in Mexico City as part of state patrimony. That's where it should be. And the fact that, of course, that it didn't end up there is a problem.
Arnold Bauer, author of The Search for the Codex Cardona on the Trail of a 16th Century Mexican Treasure. He's also emeritus professor of history at UC Davis. He spent much of the last 25 years unraveling the mystery of the origins and the whereabout of a manuscript from the mid-1500s called the Codex Cardona. Arnold, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. It's been a pleasure.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, crime novelist Peter May with his new book, Virtually Dead. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Insight streams live online at capradio.org/insight. Coming up this afternoon from Capital Public Radio News, what could happen to hundreds of unused swine flu vaccines in Sacramento County if they're not used soon, and why average state tax refunds are down about $100 this year in California. The stories and more later today on All Things Considered. The prolific crime writer Peter May is back in town with a new novel. It's called Virtually Dead. Peter May is Scottish but lives in France and is perhaps best known for his detective novel set in China, where he's also spent a lot of time. Today he's in Sacramento. Peter, welcome back to Inside.
Great. Lovely to be here again, Jeffrey.
Well, virtually dead, I guess that's better than being actually dead.
Yes, well, two different things, I guess.
What does that mean, virtually dead?
Well, the book is set in the virtual world, Second Life, and so a number of people die in Second Life, so they're virtually dead as opposed to really dead. But in real life, they're also dead too, so there's a kind of trade-off between the two.
Is it a crime to kill someone in Second Life or some other virtual world?
No. It's, in fact, you can't really kill somebody in Second Life. You can do damage to their avatar. And in theory, if you write the right kind of script, then you could probably obliterate it. But mostly that's not possible.
And when you say script, you're talking about a computer script.
Yes. Yeah. It's part of Second Life that most things that operate there are operated by scripts written by computer programmers. Yeah.
Peter May, his latest novel is titled Virtually Dead, and love to hear you read from it. This is from very early in the book. Anything we should know before you start reading?
This is from the prologue of the book, and it really, I've plunged the reader straight into the virtual world without any compromises, just for this opener, which is a little dramatic teaser, if you like, and then gradually we kind of unravel what the virtual world's all about.
Okay.
Max loved this island that he had painstakingly created over the last couple of weeks. He loved the sweep of the steeply pitched roof of his Asian house, the red-sailed yachts berthed at the decks and landing stages he had built around his little piece of tropical paradise. Blue and pink balls stood together in couplets scattered throughout the garden, pose balls for dance animations that he had placed so carefully, even though he had no idea with whom he might dance. He felt utterly at home here, safe. He clicked on the door to his house and passed from the terrace to its interior. Large windows on either side looked out on sea views. He had yet to furnish it, and he was looking forward to that with an unexpected relish. He had not anticipated that he would enjoy this world quite so much. It had an addictive quality that had taken him by surprise. Max was portly, bald, with a small greying goatee. It was not a look most people would have cultivated for this alternative existence, but Max had wanted to look like himself, a certain vanity, a sense of his own individuality. A sprinkle of sparkling light around his door told him that someone outside was trying to get in, someone not on the pass list, and he froze, his brief sense of comfort evaporating like early morning mist, to be replaced once more by the foreboding that had stalked him in hell. He called out, "Who's there?" There was no response. Even although he could almost feel the presence on the other side of the door, he was secure inside. Without a landmark, the intruder could not enter. Then, to his astonishment, he saw a blue pose ball rise in the middle of the floor. He heard a sound like a rattlesnake, and then a figure appeared, latched onto the pose ball in a strange squatting position, before standing up and turning toward him. For a moment his heart stopped, and then recognition brought an animated smile to his face, and relief surged through him. "Oh, it's you. How on earth did you get in?" But his visitor did not reply, simply standing, staring at him, arms folded, an animated sway that seemed almost hypnotic, and then in a single, swift movement of one of those folded arms, became extended, a gun held pointed at Max's chest.
That's Peter May reading from his latest novel, Virtually Dead. Where did you get the idea for this? Do you spend time in Second Life or some other virtual world?
I did. I actually got the idea when I saw a television documentary about Second Life about 3 years ago, and I knew nothing about it at that time. And they dealt with the possibilities that Second Life presented to the criminal fraternity for laundering money, for terrorists to meet up in secret without any chance of being eavesdropped on. So it seemed like fruitful territory for a crime writer. So I signed up and went in there and set up a detective agency. My avatar's called Flick Falls, and I set up the Flick Falls Detective Agency. Falls, of course, as you know, is a good Scottish name.
Yes.
To my astonishment, I got inundated with clients. In fact, my first two clients were a couple of giant geckos, which was kind of surreal. But
These are avatars, of course.
Yes, yes. But most of the business came from infidelity cases, actually.
Were those cases brought to you, your online avatar, do you think those were actual real-world cases brought into the virtual world, or was it all part of some big game and you were just participating in that?
It's hard to kind of describe this, because Second Life really is a parallel world. And when people go in there, they live quite different and distinct lives from their real-world lives. They meet people, they get partnered with people, they have sex with people, they build things, they sell things, they buy and trade land. And the cases I got were cases that were very real to the people involved in Second Life. Infidelity, as I said, was one of the major things. But there were real cases, yeah.
Were you on Second Life to do the research so that you could write a book like Virtually Dead, or were you there also or instead because you liked it?
I was there specifically to research the book. But obviously I got sucked into the whole flavor of it, the milieu. It was beyond anything that I had anticipated or expected. I mean, the sense of reality that exists there is quite amazing.
Now, in your book, it starts off in the virtual world, but the book mainly transpires in the real world. How did you figure out ways to move this virtual action into the real world? Did you talk with people whose lives had been affected significantly by their virtual existence?
I think everybody that you get to know in the virtual world who is prepared to share their real world persona with you, you get to know and understand how, in fact, the virtual world affects and changes you. And in the book, my real-world character was somebody suffering from acute grief as well as financial problems. And he had gone into Second Life on the advice of his therapist to take part in some experimental group therapy sessions there. And his character in Second Life, Chaz Chesnikov, becomes a kind of alter ego. And the experiences that that character has in Second Life, he brings out with him into First Life and in a way resolves many of the main character's problems.
Peter May's latest novel is titled Virtually Dead. I call it your latest novel. You're always producing novels. And another recent one is called The Critic. And I got an email about an hour ago from a listener in Davis called Steve who said, please say hi to Peter May. My wife Cindy's book club is reading The Critic this month, one of your books, partly for the modest UC Davis viticulture connection in the book and partly so they can stay on theme and drink wine while discussing it. So what's that book about?
Well, strangely enough, it's about wine. It's, it's set in a wine-growing region of southwest France, and it's about the murder of a famous wine critic. And I think Steve is talking about the connection with UC Davis was the flavor wheel, the taste wheel, which was created at UC Davis and plays a part in the book.
I see. Did you spend time at UC Davis doing research for that book, or was this...
not specifically for that book? But I do know Davis quite well. I have good friends who live there.
And another one of your recent books was published in French before it was in English. Obviously, your first language is English. How do you go about getting a book published in French before it's published in your native language?
Very strange one. But my French publisher bought world rights on this book. And so they were in a position then to sell on what they would call the foreign rights. And those foreign rights included English, which seemed pretty bizarre to me since I'd written it in English. But it came out in French in October to probably the best reviews of my career. And it's now been bought up all over Europe and in the UK by a publisher called Quercus, who've in fact given me a 3-book contract to turn this into a trilogy.
So you wrote it in English and then someone else translated it into French?
That's correct, yes.
But you live in France, so you presumably speak French. Do you play some part in the translation, at least making sure it's what you want it to be?
Well, yes, the translator would send me chapter by chapter the translations, which I would look at and get a feel for. It's unusual because French is a very different language from English in terms of its structure, and sentences tend to be longer, more convoluted. And I have a very short short sentence style.
Yes.
And actually, this translator worked my style through his translation pretty well, I thought.
Peter May, the book we've been talking about mainly is Virtually Dead. It's a mystery novel, but he's got other books out. He's on a U.S. tour. He's from Scotland, but lives in France. Peter, thanks for joining us again.
Great pleasure.
That's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Today's associate producer was Lynn Weaver. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. Thank you for joining us. Holocaust survivor who was a cast member of an opera first performed in a Nazi concentration camp is coming to town. On the next Insight, you'll meet Ella Stein Weisberger, who'll attend a Sacramento production of the same opera. Also, we'll talk with NPR Scott Simon, plus a Nevada County woman and her campaign to get communities to lose weight together. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow morning at 10 on Capital Public Radio.